So, Mom, I don't know if I've ever been as excited as I am today recording a podcast. I've had this idea for years, having you on the podcast, and I have wanted to ask you a lot of questions so that I can know the answers, but also so the listeners can know, because I talk about you a lot on the podcast. And then I asked people to submit questions, the listeners and the viewers on YouTube to submit questions. And the questions that they submitted were so good and so unthought of by maybe either of us that now I'm really excited to have this recording with you. And I know we're not going to get to all the questions, so I'm guessing we'll have to do this a number of times. But welcome to the podcast, Mom Honda.
Well, I'm really delighted that you even thought of me to interview because I feel, on one hand, very honored, and on the other hand, really surprised because I can't imagine that I would have anything to bring to your wonderful, deserving listeners.
Well, that's yet to be seen, Mom. Well, it all depends on how engaging and how interesting you are. Just joking. No, you have a long, interesting life. You're a smart person. You have a lot of wisdom. I talk about you a lot on the podcast, particularly in the videos, I think, about what I learned from you and
Oh, goodness.
what is a part of my perspective or life, or and certainly my emotional health certainly only exists because of you and Dad. So, there's a lot there. And I passively picked up on a lot of developmental things, child development and parenting from you because of the daycare. I would watch you interact with the kids. And of course, when I was 12, I wasn't taking notes or even caring to take notice of it, but I was so in the midst of it because it was in our house that I just noticed a lot of things. You just pick up on things. And when I'm talking on the podcast, I will often tie things from adult behavior to child experiences and different things that go right or wrong. And I'm often thinking, well, that kind of reminds me of what my mom would do in terms of how to help kids through emotional experiences, which is arguably 90% of what a daycare involves, right? So I hope we can get into it. So let's get into some of these questions, Mom. I started with some of the easier ones just to kind of start light, if you will.
We go easy and slow.
Yeah. So Patron Takara, he says, do you still make spaghetti on Gohan?
Of course, that's the only way to be
You
eating
still do?
it. Oh, yes.
That's funny. So
Oh,
for those who
yes.
don't, Gohan is rice and Japanese sticky rice, to be specific. And I talk about how we would have a giant plate wall to wall with no
Yes.
plate exposed,
Right.
with a bed of thick Gohan, right? And then a massive pile of spaghetti and sauce. Were there meatballs? I feel like there weren't meatballs.
No, I often would use just ground beef or ground turkey or
In the sauce.
yes.
Yeah.
The reason for doing that is because our family was large, and
Yeah.
in order to make your food go further, you fill up with the carbs. And so you could do that, and it didn't matter whether it was spaghetti or stew or whatever.
Beef stroganoff.
Yeah, everything
Yeah.
went on
Huh.
that bed of
So was that the primary reason?
rice.
Was it was
It
trying
would
to
increase the output.
the caloric count
And
from
tummy. It would.
Yeah.
I have a funny story
Oh.
about the tummy because we were involved with your school sports of the different kids, and it often disrupted the dinner hour. And so I hurriedly made this dish of fractured tacos that the family loved. And so you made your tomato sauce, etc., and then you put in to that sauce cooked rice. Well, one night I was in a hurry, and so I didn't quite wait till the end of the rice cooking time. It was nearly done. So the whole family, we all sat around, we ate, we gobbled, we got off to the sport it.
And it expanded in our stomachs.
It did, and it made us all miserable. Each and every one of us.
So it did too well of a job.
Yes.
That's funny. That's funny. Yeah. Well, interesting. I mean, it's also a Japanese-American thing, right? Did you learn that as from Japanese-American cuisine to have things on top
know.
Of Gohan?
I'm quite sure that Grandma Honda did influence me in that regard because...
I mean, I just figured that's a direct recipe. They ate it that way too. And so when you married Dad when you were 19, Dad wanted it that way. And you were like, okay, let's just... I have a customer of one in the kitchen.
Yeah.
So that's what he wants and that's what we'll make. And then as each kid was introduced to the family. I was pretty old before I knew that normal people didn't have spaghetti with Gohan, or that literally, the big joke in our family was that we would go to our white friends' homes for dinner and we would report back and say, you can see plate in between the different food items. You have your pork chop and your corn and your potatoes, and there's actually clean plate in between the three different elements of the meal. Growing up for us, it was always just a lot of food and a lot of it and wall to wall, you know, and giant glasses of whole milk. And we ate a lot growing up.
Well, it was really important to Dad and I that we provided good meals. And for a long time, you wouldn't buy lunch, you would take your lunch.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure I've told you this at some point. So the most common thing for kids in school was that their parents would send them to school with money to buy a school lunch. It's just so much easier, right, to send I think it was like $1.20 or something. But you almost never did that. Even among people that had homemade lunches, the lunch that you made was always like way beyond what other people would make. Most people would have like a real smushed PB&J with an apple that had also smushed it in the bag, and maybe a carrot or something. And you would have two giant sandwiches with like turkey and mayo and cheese and lettuce, and not just one, but two. And then a giant Ziploc bag full of Doritos or Cheetos or something. And then a Capri Sun back when that was not a thing. I mean, I remember I would come to school and in the fifth grade, my friends like Chris White, you remember Chris White, he every day would ask if he could buy one of my sandwiches.
That's funny.
And so occasionally I would make like 50 cents or a dollar from selling your food on the black market, Mom.
And you didn't share this with me.
No, I didn't.
We could have had a business school.
I mean, yeah, it's funny. We could have. But it was, at the time, I didn't appreciate it, I guess. But looking back, I think like how interesting that is that when I'm sitting there eating my lunch, probably somewhat thinking, well, my mom puts a lot of effort into me. You know, into our food, and all the other kids, you know, I'm guessing their parents love them, but maybe not as much as my mom loves me.
Oh, surely that was it. Well, and also when you are in the kitchen cooking, I've read this to be true. I don't know if it's true, but when you are the cook, you are instilling love into that dish or that offering of food. So that is a wonderful thing to be taking in.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and I didn't realize this also growing up, just how much that idea is infused in our lives. Other families don't necessarily think that way. They communicate love maybe in a different way, and that's fine. But what is communicated through food, not only the making of it, the preparation of it, the amount of it, but the eating of it as well, the appreciation of it. I find myself when I'll go to someone's house and I'm not the, you know, like if I'm going to one of Stacy's relative's house or something and they have extra food that they're offering for people to take home with them afterwards. And I always have this huge instinct to be appreciative, to show appreciation and actually not only because it's it's good food and it's useful to me, but it's a gesture that I appreciate what they are giving. It's not impolite. It's not greedy.
No, when, it is not.
You know, when you are a host, one of the best things that someone can do as they're walking out the door is take food with them, you know, that you have extra, because you're not going to eat all of it.
And, well, it's such a compliment to whoever had contributed to that meal to be able to say, oh, they liked it enough to take it home.
Right. I mean, not only did they power through the food at the event, but they liked it so much that they actually want to have it a second time at home. Mm-hmm. And I find that most people don't have that instinct. They don't think like that, you know what I mean? Or at least anecdotally. Along those lines, mom, patron Lise from Belgium, they ask, what is your favorite Japanese food?
My favorite Japanese food would have to be rice.
Wow.
It is so adaptable.
A particular kind of rice?
Oh yes, the sticky Japanese rice. Yeah. What I learned to say gohan, and in our family it was always gohan. But that rice, you can make sandwiches out of it. I mean, actually, they call them onigiri, and you can put things inside that are yummy, like tuna fish or salted plum. You can wrap seaweed and rice go really well together. Actually, rice and anything goes together. Mm-hmm. If you're sick, putting hot green tea poured over rice will just, you know, it's a bland sort of comfort food. If you can't take anything else, maybe you can take that. And you can put it into soups, and it's just so adaptable. Hmm. I love it.
Well, it's comforting that that's your favorite food, because you were not forced, but you were thrown into the Japanese-American experience, including the food, when you married Dad. And the rice gohan culture is very strong in the Japanese. I mean, full disclosure, there will be times like at Thanksgiving, for example. Japanese-American Thanksgiving has all the regular turkey and the cranberries and the stuffing, but we have like this whole second section of the food experience, which is all the Japanese-American comfort food items like gohan and whatnot. And at Thanksgiving, sometimes I don't have gohan, and Dad will say, well, you forgot to get gohan. And I'm like, yeah, I think I'm going to pass, because it's kind of filling, and I'm trying to eat like other more kind of important things. And Dad will just be aghast. You know, it's sacrilegious. It's like a...
Well, what doesn't go with gohan? You just need gohan to go with something, your gravy or your cranberry sauce or your turkey.
Yeah, but, you know, there's a reason why at a buffet they have bread, because it's cheap and it fills you up, and so you don't eat the more expensive things that people want. You know, a buffet style Thanksgiving, I have a similar kind of principle that I follow. I've just said, well, don't, because you're going to eat a lot and you're going to want to eat a lot of different things, so don't fill up. But it's comforting to know, because I could have seen that going either way. I could have seen for you saying, like, I don't want to have gohan again for the rest of my life because of just how much I've had to deal with it, like every day, literally every day from, I'm guessing, 1963 until Kevin was old enough maybe to eat on his own. But even beyond that, you probably...
Oh, we still do. We have it every day.
Every day.
Every day.
Still.
But let me tell you this. When I was growing up, my mom wasn't the greatest of cooks. She managed, and I came from a family of five children, but I loved mashed potatoes. Absolutely adored them. I would eat as much as I could, and she rarely would fix it. I could go down the hallway and look into the dining room, and there would be our meal. So I could get kind of excited going down the hallway. But when I saw like an ice cream scoop, I thought, oh my, of white something on my plate, I thought we were going to have mashed potatoes. I was just excited. And then I'd get to my plate and it would be rice. And so rice was a big disappointment to me growing up. Why did my mother choose rice over mashed potatoes? I never figured it out. But once I did, as an adult, asked her, and she said that my dad had to work a lot of construction, go from boarding house to boarding house or small town to small town, and they always had mashed potatoes. So he really did not care for them. That's why they were never on our plate.
Huh.
And I thought, well, now that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because I craved them and he couldn't stand them.
Yeah. Huh. And they were probably bad mashed potatoes.
Could be. I don't know. But just too much of a good thing.
I don't think I knew that level of detail about your dad, that when they were young, in 20s, 30s.
And or even before, as a teenager.
Oh, okay.
He traveled.
He was started at the bottom with construction. One of the most significant conversations I ever had with him or in my life was when he told me about, so I'd graduated with my bachelor's degree and I was having a hard time getting my career going. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I had a business degree and I just had this impression that they just handed you a career and they didn't, you know? And so I was suddenly faced with the reality of networking and applying and getting experience, of which I had none of. And so I couldn't find a job. And the only jobs I could seemingly qualify for were really jobs for high schoolers before graduation. Like I got a job at a Foot Locker, you know, I got a job as a shoe salesman for like minimum wage. And I was talking to Granddad about it on the phone and I was upset about it. And he said, well, when I started out as a cement mixer, and what he was indicating was he started out at the lowest level on the construction site. Then he worked his way up to, swinging a hammer, and then eventually he's a foreman, and then eventually he's an architect, and then eventually he's a contractor, eventually he's a construction magnate in Spokane, a well-known construction figure to the point where he was man of the year in Spokane. And he worked his way up, and I only knew him in my life as this very successful person, and I would have thought that he got a career right out of graduating with his BA, and he said, no, you know, I started as a cement mixer. And so it instantly changed my perspective to, okay, everyone starts at the bottom, and that's just how it goes. And so it completely switched my perspective and how I saw where I was in life, you know, and started at the bottom, you know, and then eventually I switched careers and became a therapist, but I didn't know that. So when he was doing that kind of work, it was very itinerant, if you will, and mm-hmm. he's traveling around the Kansas area, probably in neighboring states, right? Different jobs, and he's living in boarding houses, and he's away from your mom, even though they're married. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, often when he could, he would, and to the degree of involvement with a particular job, he would take his family. So they did a lot of moving around
right.
as well.
Yeah.
But
including moving to Spokane from Kansas for a job. He saw from Kansas to Spokane that Spokane was an up-and-coming city.
Well, not really.
Oh.
The company he was working for, Bus Boom and Rao, they sent him to the Northwest. And it was after World War II. They had the foresight to think that after the war there would be a lot of building. And so where would be a good place to have a branch? And so they thought Northwest. They sent my father and his young family to the Northwest to scope it out, I guess would be the word.
You and your three older siblings.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, Spokane wasn't really much.
It wasn't. It was the heart of the Inland Empire, as they call it.
Well, they were trying to advertise themselves as such.
And it wasn't until I am so dense or naive or something, but it was brought to my attention that we moved to Spokane in 1946, and then my dad's success really burst because in a matter of 8 years, he now had this new home.
Really fancy house.
Yes.
I just wish the listeners, I could just walk them through this house. To this day, it's built in the 50s, but to this day, if you walked through this house today, you would say, whoa, this is beautiful. It's interesting. It's nice. There's different themes.
Textures.
And then your mom, interior designed the rug and the vases and the art and the curtains and the wallpaper and the bathrooms. And there was a literal Japanese garden in the middle of the house.
Growing, fresh. I mean, it's a fresh
with living plants, garden. With rocks and a waterfall that looked great down to a koi pond downstairs and a beautiful wood with brass railings.
Copper.
Oh, copper. Wow.
Copper railing.
A circular... a spiral, like grand staircase that you would see maybe in a really nice hotel in like Los Angeles or something. And then it was half in, half out. The garden was in the backyard. There were these, floor to ceiling windows and
skylight.
And the backyard was nice and vaulted ceilings. And it was just an amazing, amazing house that you just don't see people doing. And I loved it when you and Dad came over just now and both of you said, this is kind of, you've decorated, because it's been a while since you've been over, which I hadn't realized. You said, this is kind of like grandma's house. And that's just the best thing. Geraldine, my cousin, your niece, is probably listening to this. Undoubtedly is listening to this.
She will.
And
hi, Geraldine.
We talk sometimes about how we're trying to recreate grandma's and granddad's house. It was a really just beautiful, beautiful house. And so, I always thought of granddad as this super rich, very successful guy. But you saw him make that transition very, very quickly and very significantly, right?
Yes. And like I said, I wasn't aware of how quickly, being in the midst of it and everything. But looking back, to be a struggling young family that came to Spokane and to do exploratory work and construction, try to get your footing into a new town. And then, boom, 8 years' time makes such a change. He and Mom were always interested in travel. And so that also blossomed out because the children were getting older. They had more free time and he was getting more successful, so he had more free time probably too.
Yeah, I joke that a lot of my family heirlooms from Japan, my Japanese decor in my house, little items, 99% of them are from my white grandparents, because they actually went to Japan because they could afford to do so, and they bought things because they could afford to do so. My Japanese side was poor and couldn't go to Japan and couldn't buy things. And so, a lot of the Japanese, aside from grandma's kimono, my Japanese grandma's kimono is right there. But there's a lot of things around this house where they'll be like, oh, this is like from your Japanese heritage. And I'll be like, well, yes and no, it's actually from my white grandparents. but they eventually, I think kind of through Dad, fell in love with Japan. And
there's a story to that.
Oh.
Through Dad or through our marriage, actually. So we got married in 1963. And at that time, Spokane was wanting to create the idea of a sister city.
Yeah, because Seattle has Kobe.
Yes.
And Spokane wanted a sister city as well. Yeah.
And I don't know when the talks to do all of that were happening, probably years and months ahead of our marriage, surely. But once we got married, those within the white community leadership and the Japanese leadership,
so the context is,
came together.
Well, the context, this is pretty close after World War II.
Yes.
Where, particularly on the West Coast, the Japanese enemy was feared and ferocious.
Repulsive. You didn't want to have anything to do.
Yeah, to the point where they locked up Dad's family and relatives. in prisons, literally. They call them camps, but that conjures a much happier vision than what was the reality. And it's, in fact, it's worse than prison because they didn't have insulation. They were in the middle of Wyoming, like the bitter winters of Wyoming, with plywood walls and no insulation.
They're trying to really get away from the concentration camp concept and call them internment camps because they were being punished. They were being...
Yeah. There were guard stations with machine guns nests pointing inward. They weren't...
Inward, yeah, yes.
They and barbed wire fence. Well, before we get into this, Mom, I feel like I want to get back to some of these questions because...
I agree.
We're going off topic, but I do want to get back because I know there are questions about the interracial marriage that we'll get to in a second. So we're on question number 3 out of, 100 questions. Patron Tracy, she asks, does the constant slurping of your kids bother you? My husband is from Japan, and he had to stop slurping because I couldn't stand it. So for context, I will occasionally talk about this or literally do it on the podcast where I'll be drinking coffee and I'll slurp. And I didn't realize that that wasn't normal until I was with Stacy, and she would be like, could you not slurp? Why are you slurping when you drink coffee? And I was like, huh? And I actually tried to physically drink coffee without slurping, and it's like impossible. I can't, it feels like I'm just pouring liquid down my face. And, you know, slurping, it feels more controlled or something. I don't know. So I must have gotten that from Dad and the slurping of soup and kind of the shoveling of Gohan into your face from the Chawan bowl, right? So does that bother you?
I would have to say it never did. I wasn't aware of it until now.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. I am aware of good table manners. I wanted that to be...
Yeah, you and Dad were sticklers for table manners.
Mm-hmm. And if we were going to take you out to a restaurant, we wanted you to behave and know restaurant behavior, which home behavior should be the same.
Yeah.
So the slurping is interesting to me. I guess I don't recall Dad slurping his coffee.
So for context, you're in high school, you meet Dad, and you have this secret relationship. And we'll get into this later, but for people to know. So you didn't see each other very often because you couldn't, because your parents in particular were adamant that you not date Dad, or that if you did, it would be very brief or something.
When they became aware, they weren't adamant until they became aware that he could very well be in the picture.
Meaning you might marry him or something. Mm-hmm. Then that's when your parents got really upset, and particularly your dad.
Well, and I put this on them myself. Well, looking back, I felt there wouldn't be any acceptance if I were to bring Dad home as a boyfriend.
Yeah.
And so
I thought that was explicitly told to you. I thought they set a rule that said you couldn't see it.
Okay, here's the deal. First of all, we're interested in one another.
Yeah. In high school.
In high school. I was a junior. He was a senior. And it began in April of the school year. But I was unsure.
And just to backtrack a little bit, he was dating your friend.
Yes.
And Dad wasn't into her as much as she was into him or something?
Well, she was a friend of mine. And
another white girl.
Right.
Yeah.
Adorable. She was so cute. She's a tiny little thing. And
she's still with us?
Yes, she lives in Bend, Oregon, and I still communicate with her. But she was adorable, just this little pixie of a thing. And so she would put her whole thing into her relationship. And so it was a brand new thing. She was dating Alan, and she was very excited about it. And it was going places. They were having a date here and there.
Was it a topic of interest that Dad was Japanese and she was white?
No, not particularly.
Would it have surprised you if another friend came forward and said, like, what is your dad going to say or something?
Oh, I couldn't date naughty boys, you know, and then I would be unsure about bringing naughty boys, yeah. What I call naughty boys. I don't know.
I'm just trying to understand that the landscape. As I know, there was a lot of racism, obviously, and a lot.
There was for the city. There was. I don't know about the school.
Again, post World War II.
Right. So. Right. Definitely in the city. As far as my peers, I just associated with people who must have been more open-minded, because I never within my friend group, that just wasn't an issue.
What if you had dated a black guy?
It might have been questioned. We just didn't have very many, even though it was an inner city school, we didn't have very many black families.
Yeah. And there weren't that many Japanese people either.
No.
Yeah. Mm-mm. And for those following along, at Lewis and Clark High School in Spokane.
It's inner city.
Yeah. Dad was, so think of the song Billy Joel, Uptown Girl. Mom literally lived up a hill in the rich neighborhood near Comstock Park. And Dad literally lived downtown by the train tracks. When they decided to build I-90 straight through Spokane, they built it a half block away from Dad's old house, because typically when you're building a freeway through the middle of town and the government seizes land, they take it from the poor people. So this was literally like the dusty, mm-hmm. poor area, you know. I mean, it wasn't destitute, but...
No, it was really a lovely area, primarily populated by the Japanese. Mm. And they're very proud people and took care of their properties. Also, there were some black families who felt the same. They were proud and...
Yeah, black family lived right next to next to Dad's house.
And happy to take care of, you know, wanting to take good care of their property.
Totally.
So it was just...
But modest living conditions.
Right, and it would be available land.
Yeah. So the inner city high school issue was that the uptown girls would go down the hill and go to the inner city high school along with everyone else. Mm-hmm. So there's just more mixing. Okay, so then you start dating Dad, and in your head, there's, and just for context, at this time in 1961 or whatever, when you're dating Dad, or 60, a couple states over in Wyoming, it's literally illegal for Japanese people to marry white people. It's against the law. It's on the books. Legislatures stood up and unanimously passed a law that said you could not get married. This is, you know, not that far of a drive from Spokane, and that's the context. So you have that sentiment around, and yet Mom and her friends are like progressive, social justice-minded individuals that just don't care about such things.
Well, people were people. It didn't matter what their color was.
Right, but I'm quite sure that the majority of kids in your school, or a sizable percentage, and particularly their parents and families, would not have been excited about their white kids dating anyone other than other white kids, right?
Right, and that would have been... probably oozed in by osmosis into the children. So the prospect of dating Dad, I guess I wanted to know, where is it going before I...
Dad hit on you, right? Didn't he call you over? So he broke up with...
Well, he didn't break up. He
ghosted her or something.
Yeah.
Drifted.
He drifted.
Passively switched from, but he met you or got to know you better through his girlfriend at the time, and then randomly calls you out of the blue, right?
Yes.
And you're like, oh, did you have a hot conversation with your friend, or did you just let it slide?
Well, I let it slide because I really didn't know, again, where is this going? Uh-huh. This is out of the blue. Why call me? When I believed that he was having, when I say relationship, I'm calling it a relationship, but it's high school. I mean, remember that. It's just high school dating. And so there was something happening there that I wanted to recognize. So I just stayed mum on it.
Okay.
With my friend. And then he worked it out. I don't know. I do kind of think he did ghost her.
Ghosting was a lot easier back then, since it was harder to text someone. So then when you're with him, at what point do you start to realize, oh, there might be some pushback from my parents?
Well, I don't know. I was too involved with the romantic side of our relationship that I... And so it continued. And really, it's slow motion when you're in high school or early, you know, college or something. We didn't have texting. We didn't have ways to stay in touch. Mm-hmm. And so...
And not a lot of dating outside of school.
No.
So you saw each other at school in between classes.
Right.
Slow motion meaning that it would take a long time to deepen a relationship because you just didn't have a lot of time together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so, like I said, we started to date in April, and then he graduates.
What did you like about him?
What did I like about him? I liked his shoulders. Well, it's kind of silly, but they were strong and broad, and I guess I hadn't really taken interest in a man's shoulders or a boy's physique.
And you didn't have a lot of dating experience prior to that.
No,
Of girls didn't back then, right?
No.
You did famously date Craig T. Nelson, the actor.
Yes, but I never dated him.
He was in love with you in grade school up until like the seventh grade or something.
I suppose, but we didn't date.
Right. But he had a crush on you. He wrote you a love letter at some point.
He did, and he invited me to his birthday party. I gave him a dribble glass.
Oh, a joke glass?
Yeah, where if you drank, then
did
it would
like
dribble
it?
Onto your shirt.
Did he like it?
I don't know.
He just walked
but
away.
But I was the only girl invited to his birthday party. Well.
So for those who don't know, Craig T. Nelson famously... of the TV show Coach and a million other shows that he's been in. And when you have high school reunions, you and him catch up. So when you are starting to date Dad, you are taking it slow. You're kind of inexperienced. You like his shoulders. What else did you like about him?
I liked his voice.
Yeah.
And he was kind. He was gentle. He talked softly.
Was that nice? Because your dad is not a soft talker.
No, no.
Your dad is a loud, booming. You'll hear him from a mile away.
Well, he enters the room and you feel his presence.
Yeah.
He just had this presence about him. But Alan was just a kind person, and he dressed. Fashionably, I don't know if people even pay attention, but he was clean. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he's always been a clean guy.
I don't know a more romantic way to say clean, but.
And for context, you and Dad are the same height, so
yes.
It's not like he's this towering figure of masculinity over Mom. You know, pretty similar weight and bone structure and stuff. So, but at the same time, Dad, you know, when he was younger,
he was an athlete.
Yeah, he was a strong. I just remember as a kid, I was just marveling at his forearms. He just seemed to have like these giant forearms. You know, at what point did, and I know someone asked this, I can't see the question right now, but when did you know that Dad was the one? And how did you know Dad was the one? I think people are asking this question because they're thinking for themselves, how does one know? Because you've been with Dad for 60 years, married, you've been with him for 63 years or something. So how did you know all the way back then that you would spend the rest of your life with him?
I didn't. I get the feeling from time to time that there's a connection with one person or another. There, you just have a connection. It just feels good to be around that person. That person makes you feel important, that you're someone special. So I think it was that evolved through our letters, because we didn't text, we wrote letters to one another. It developed that way. It wasn't a boom moment, although I did like the way, if we also in those days they had bench seats in the car, and so you could sit right up next to the driver, and he would put his arm around me.
And there were no seatbelt laws back then.
Yeah, so. No seatbelt laws. Put his arm around me, and then he would kiss the top of my head.
Mm.
And that just sent chills down here. Just silly things.
So you're nestling up in his giant shoulders and he kisses you on the top of the head and
yeah.
You just melt in his arms.
Well, and then our first six dates were to a drive-in movie.
Oh, right. We've talked about this before. And we all know what high schoolers did at drive-in movies.
We didn't watch the movie. I remember one movie was Gone with the Wind.
That's a long one.
Yes. And the only thing I remember is a great fire on the screen. Jeez,
the whole movie, Mom?
That's the whole movie, and that's all I remember.
Wow. I mean, that's a lot of necking, as they used to call it, right? I mean, how did you have the stamina? Did you come up for air? Did you have, like, did someone hand you bottles of water so you could, like, hydrate during that? I mean, that's a lot of intense necking. That's a marathon. Wow. Was that your first drive-in movie experience?
Mm-hmm.
So Dad was your first kind of foray into that world. And was it the first time for Dad?
Oh, you'll have to ask him. I don't know. But
my impression was he wasn't extremely experienced in that realm before.
Probably not. I don't know. I thought he was the big man on campus because he was.
Oh.
He was athletic, so he was on the football team, and he was a cheerleader for the...
There was a male cheer squad.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so he was a cheerleader his senior year, and they hadn't ever had a male cheer squad until that year.
Mm. It was like six guys,
mm-hmm.
and they would wear their Letterman's jackets, and they had the cones that they would yell out, I'm mm-hmm. guessing, right? Basketball games and stuff, right? But yeah, he played football and baseball and basketball.
And he was just known. He may have been school treasurer or something. I don't know. You know, held an office. But he was just known. He was a popular guy.
Huh, okay.
And incredibly handsome.
Oh, okay. So when did you know that you wanted to get married, the two of you?
Well, I'll tell you what was a big deciding factor. After a year, so he graduates, and then I finish my senior year. So it was at the end of my senior year that did we go together? I don't remember. I think Alan and I went together to Mom and Dad. I mean, I was, of course, living at home. And I told them that I wanted to date Alan.
Openly.
Openly, yeah.
And that meant having him over to the house, maybe?
Right. And and he could come to the door and pick me up. Before that, that wasn't possible.
And that clandestine behavior was why before that point?
Well, I've thought about it. And it wasn't because they said anything. I felt they would say something.
You just knew.
In my immaturity, they're not going to approve of this. They're not going to like this one bit.
Because he's Japanese or because he's a guy?
Because he's Japanese and because he's a guy. Because I didn't date very many people.
Yeah. The question of
the whole
a
dating,
serious relationship,
yes,
was not necessarily an expectation that you would be doing that at that mm-hmm. at that age. I don't know if I just have this as a made-up story or you told me, but I thought that your parents had, because you were the princess of the family, not that you were necessarily spoiled, but the...
Well, my siblings would say I was spoiled.
Yeah, so you have these three older siblings that are like 10 years older than you, and they grew up during the tough times, and then you come along, and you're born
a nuisance.
Younger sister, but also born into the family when you're doing well. You had this, your own bedroom, and it was all pink, and you know, they designed a bedroom just around you and around the ideal of a little white blonde girl, and you could argue bullied by your older siblings, right? And my impression was that as a part of the whole status thing, you know, because your parents grew up in modest conditions and had extremely especially your dad grew up and was very poor,
very, very poor,
like living in a shack kind of a thing with probably just like a fireplace to keep you warm at night, that kind of thing.
Large family.
Yeah. And his mom was what we probably imagine to be depressed, maybe bipolar, in and out of institutions.
She would sit and stare.
Okay. And his dad, your dad's dad, was a construction worker who lost his leg in an accident because it went gangrene because he had an injury. And he didn't take over the mothering of the children. He basically just kind of made the kids into orphans. They went to an orphanage for a while.
He took the older ones to work with him because they were boys, and the older boys could at least do some help.
And they're 7 years old and stuff.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of poverty, a lot of neglect. And then I'm just guessing that as they were suddenly thrown into riches and in a new town where they could reinvent it was sort of like Great Gatsby kind of stuff where...
Who, my father?
Yeah, and mom, where they could suddenly now have this beautiful, you know, possibly one of, if not the best home in Spokane, because it was designed by him with all the modern accoutrement, you know, modern appliances, stuff, appliances that people would be wowed at today. Their fridge was amazing. I want their fridge. It was a built-in fridge.
Stainless steel.
Yeah, I mean, there was so many, there was a barbecue that was both inside and outside and this big brick hearth kind of thing, and it was just amazing. And they have all the nice clothes and they can travel, and they have this bar downstairs where they could entertain, and they have they have parties and stuff. And so you are the belle of the ball kind of a thing, where they're gonna parade you around, kind of, you know, that's like, look at Susan, who is this beautiful up and coming our daughter, our special daughter, right? And so she is going to go to college at Washington State, you know, Cougars, which was also loved by your family because, you know, Spokane's near Washington State University. And my impression was you were going to go to sorority and you're going to meet a good white frat guy, fraternity guy, who was upper crust, and you were going to live the dream, the white American post-war dream, and that was going to be an additional, you know, I don't want to say status symbol for your parents, but something along those lines, or that was the ideal that was fed to them, maybe by society or something. And then you come home and tell them that you're dating a Japanese guy from the inner city of Spokane. So how did they react?
Well, not very happily.
To say the least.
And they said, okay, we will give you 3 dates and to call it off.
So is this their way of accommodating, or?
Yes, like they were meeting me halfway.
Right, because they could have said no and never
see each other again.
But they're like, well, we don't want you to be a mean person, so, you know, let them down easy.
Well, and so we did. We
took advantage.
We took advantage of those 3 days.
Because he could actually come to the door.
Yes, yeah. And we could feel like a couple, and it felt really fun. And then after the 3 dates, then we went back to secretly dating.
Yeah.
So...
And you would tell your parents that you were going to a friend's house or something.
Well, by that time I was at the sorority, so there wasn't much. They didn't ask about Alan because they believed I obeyed them.
So you go off to Wazoo, to Washington State, and you're in a sorority. You're in Pi Phi's?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you are dating Dad from afar. He doesn't live in Pullman. He's about an hour or two living in Spokane still, maybe going to Eastern Washington University at that point. And you're secretly dating, perhaps some more drive-in movie theaters.
Well, we're secretly having a relationship because we're in different cities and writing letters and so forth. So, yeah.
I think I have one of those letters, actually.
I have a good number of them. Sadly, when my mom did find out that I was dating Alan during my college year, it was in the spring, and she asked me, did we write letters? Because at the time, calling long distance was really expensive. Mm-hmm. So it would be a letter writing situation. And I said yes. And so she had me show them the letters to her. And she says, we're taking all those letters and we're going to burn them. So we went down, took them, put them in the trash barrel.
How are you feeling at the time? How are you feeling at the time?
Oh, I was terribly distraught. I still am to this day.
Yeah.
Really bothers me. But we put them in the trash barrel and burned them, stood there.
And I'm guessing they had a long talk with you about it needs to end, right?
They don't talk. They tell. And I was to obey. I'm not very good at that, I guess.
Mm-hmm. That must have been weird for them because you're not a rebellious person. You weren't as a teenager.
No.
So to learn that you had disobeyed for so long about something so fundamental must have been quite a shock to them.
Well, I'm sure they didn't know what to make of it. I didn't know what to make of it myself.
Yeah.
But it wasn't going to influence my future with Alan.
Yeah. You knew that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was firm on that, that you can do anything you'd like.
Yeah. Well, how did you find that inner strength?
I don't really know. I don't know where one acquires those.
Because you were basically a child.
I was a child.
Yeah.
I don't even think of myself as being stubborn. I think I became stubborn, but certainly I was stubborn with regard to this.
Why?
It was important to me.
And for context, I don't know if you want to get into it, but the, I'm just going to say it, abuse from your parents to you was severe. It goes way beyond what we're saying in this moment because of all this. You know, it wasn't just like this one moment.
Mm-hmm.
It got physical and severe. And so there was a lot. And of course, just your parents' disapproval of you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe your whole community. I don't know. That was your whole life, was your family, right? And to have that, have them turn on you in that way, was a big deal. You would just imagine that a kid, a child, would have second thoughts, but you didn't.
No,
and why? You know, like, how did you find that?
I don't know. I remember my uncle, maybe they asked him because he was a favorite uncle of mine at the time.
Which uncle?
Uncle Dale.
Uncle Dale.
He talked to me and he said, you know, you want to think of the future. You want to, where is this going to lead? And he was talking nicely and everything. And I just turned off listening. And when he was done talking, I got up and went to my bedroom. It had absolutely no impact on me.
Huh. Do you think your parents' very hands-off approach to parenting played a role? Because they weren't.
They did have a hands-off.
Right. And what often will happen is that the kids will learn to be very independent to the point where if the parents suddenly decide to get involved, the kid has a pretty solid idea of who they are and their own decisions and feel they've been left to their own devices. Famously, you are 3 years old and wandering the neighborhood.
Yes, some of the best years were when I lived in that first house. I knew that neighborhood.
Yeah. You would walk up to the kindergarten class because you longed to be with other kids and to be in kindergarten, and you would creepily peer in through the window watching the kindergarten class.
I climbed on the outside, the exterior wall.
You had to kind of scale
yes,
over.
Yes,
on bricks that were kind of sticking out, and you're looking in through this window about 5 feet above the ground, and the teacher and kids would occasionally, that little curly blonde girl is looking at us again. And
it was disruptive to the classroom.
Right, but very much left to your own devices. And so do you think that might have played a role?
Well, looking back, and maybe you could analyze it better, but yes, they didn't guide me. They didn't particularly support me. They led me different directions as a youngster to golf and acrobatics and diction and, you know, opportunities, I guess.
But there weren't long, deep conversations with you about how you felt or where you were going.
Oh, we never talked. There was never any conversations at all. And I think I passed that on to you guys because I don't think that I was very good at guiding and suggesting resources or what you could do about this or that because I didn't know. I didn't have answers.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're right. When they did take a stand and say, this is what we require of you, it didn't sit well with me.
Yeah.
You're now becoming involved.
Yeah, right. All of a sudden now you're interested in my decisions mm-hmm. and my life like you weren't prior. I gave up a long time ago on.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted you to be involved more emotionally when I was young, but I'm over it now. So mm-hmm. I'm not really interested in your opinion. You're just another person telling me an opinion. Great. Thanks for sharing. But mm-hmm. I've been living my own life for a long time.
I really was independent. I loved it. I thought life was good. I had a place where I could go to get a cookie if I knocked on the door, and I had
in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. And I knew all the bushes to hide under if I wanted to spy, or which trees were good for climbing.
So, to kind of conclude this chapter, you end up at that point. So it's in the spring of your freshman year in college, and your parents find out and proceed to abuse you and put their foot down. But soon at this point, I can cut this out, but you get pregnant.
Yes.
With Mark, with mm-hmm. my older brother, Mark. And you are, again, freshman in college. You would have been just 19 at that point. Dad would have been 19 as well, turning 20 soon. So you get pregnant. I'm guessing for you and Dad, you think, well, at some point we'll get married, but we're kind of young and we're working on our schooling right now. So let's
get our life a little bit more established.
Yeah.
And
beyond half a year of college.
Right.
So you get pregnant, then what?
So then we had decisions to make. And happily, Dad stepped right up beautifully. I mean, he just really wasn't upset about it at all. He was really quite excited.
Yeah, you've said before that you and Dad would have conversations prior about how many kids you wanted. And you always both wanted big families, I think. You both come from a family of five kids,
mm-hmm.
and I think both of you, on some early date, revealed to each other that you both wanted to have five kids.
I wanted 12.
Oh, and Dad wanted five or something?
Yeah.
Okay. And it was a conversation. You're both are very family-oriented. You come from big families and you were oriented that way very early with each
other. Well, I had a real special relationship with my younger brother.
Yeah.
And he was my family. He's the family that I relate to
yeah.
when I say family.
Right, right. And you wanted to create that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Huh. That is, I don't know if I ever thought about that because, you know, my conceptualization of your family is a lot more elaborate than I've talked about already. But, you know, I've already touched on some of those themes and the distance and the abuse and the bullying and the distance. But you're not a distant person, really. You're a warm, family-oriented, inviting, complimentary.
Needy.
No.
I loved my little brother because he loved me back.
Well,
that was brand new.
Well, I don't know if I've ever thought about it, but that relationship was perhaps the only close relationship that you had ever experienced prior having your family of your own. And that warmth and that mutual dependence and that kindness and attachment, without that with your younger brother, you might have been completely lost in the woods once you started your own family.
I don't know.
Because you didn't have that with your parents, and you didn't have that with your older siblings. So without that with your younger brother, where would you have been?
It would be interesting to contemplate. But he was 7 years younger, you know, so he wasn't close in age. But I was responsible for him in a lot of ways, would babysit him but be put in charge of his care and well-being while he was growing up. And I loved him like a mom.
It's interesting because the inner resources that you had, even at that phase of life, is notable, because it would have been very tempting for you to bully him in the way you were being bullied and to be distant from him in the way you're being distanced from this child, because that's often what happens is, you know, kids do what they see. And so interesting.
Or he could have been my nuisance, like I was a nuisance to my older siblings.
Right.
He could have been a nuisance, but he wasn't.
But there's a choice that you made, a perspective, something. So you get pregnant and you decide to elope, correct? Did Dad propose to you? I forget. Or did you just decide as a team?
I think it was a team effort.
But Dad gave you a ring.
Oh, that came prior to the pregnancy.
Oh, like a promise ring? Like a pseudo engagement ring? Do you still have that ring?
No, sadly.
What happened to it?
It fell off my finger.
Oh.
Just recently. In my life recently, it was about 3 years ago.
Really? So you wore that ring. That was the ring that you wore? That was the wedding ring?
You're going to make me cry because I'm just devastated that fell off my finger.
It was that gold band.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. That was the same ring. Yeah, I didn't know that was the ring. Wow. That's amazing. And you lost it where?
Grocery shopping at high-end grocery.
What, Whole Foods or Metro Markets?
Yeah, Metropolitan Market.
And you figure it must have fallen off in the store?
Yeah, store or parking lot,
yeah. And someone just took it and didn't turn it in.
Well, they didn't turn it in. It wasn't turned in. It could be very unnoticeable.
How long? So a few years ago?
Only 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, that sucks.
Or before we moved here.
But. Yeah.
I would love to have that ring.
Yeah, that's too bad. So then you decide as a team, well, we always knew we were going to get married.
Mm-hmm.
This just rushes things a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe someday I'll take a class on birth control. But that ship has sailed. So lesson learned. And one too many drive-in movies. And so then you decide to get married, but you know you can't do it out in the open because that's not going to work.
Well, my parents had made their stand that they didn't go for this.
Yeah.
So I made my stand that I was going to proceed.
Right. Side note, Dad's community and family were more accepting of an interracial marriage, but not necessarily enthusiastic.
They were not enthusiastic at all, no. What would be the benefit? I mean, you know,
you're just going to cause troubles
for
you and your kids. And,
yes.
And your dad went to their house and banged on the door and told Dad's parents to keep their son away from you, that kind of thing. And And it was rare back then, especially in Spokane. It was a little more prevalent in Seattle or Los Angeles or something, but pretty rare across the United States, not only interracial marriage, but particularly between Japanese and white people. So you decide to elope, and you elope to Idaho. There's a little shack that was for weddings.
No, it was a cute little home that was probably built in the 30s or something, a cottage type home.
Yeah, little house.
Clapboard. And it had a big picture window Yeah. You remember that?
And it was your last day of college. Mm-hmm. So you had everything packed up and you're leaving Pullman and you're going straight. Dad comes, picks you up. You go straight to Idaho. You have it all planned out. Coincidentally, they're open because we found out later that there was a good chance they would have been closed.
They weren't open. Oh. We had to knock on the window and then we noticed this note saying they were closed, but you could call this number. Well, again, no cell phone. And we didn't have a marriage license either. And this little house was across the street from the courthouse. So we ran over to the courthouse, which was about to close. We didn't look into anything. And we got our license, and they said, you're going to have to call for them to come and see if they will come. Mm-hmm. And so that was what we did. We made a phone call.
And you had a friend, dad yes. had a friend, Bob, mm-hmm. another Japanese-American guy, and he was a witness because you need a second witness. So it was like the phlebotomist or something, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. My maid of honor was the phlebotomist.
Right. Because you also didn't know that you needed to have witnesses. Right?
Or even blood work.
I mean, you had blood work, yeah.
They had to test for the Rh factor.
Okay. Some kind of recessive gene that they mm-hmm. had some regulation around. And you get married and you are given a gift certificate for a cake.
Correct? Yes.
And then you walk down the street and get your cake and have a slice of cake. And then now's the business for getting back home. Were you showing by that point?
Oh, goodness, no.
Okay. Mm-mm. It would have just been a few months.
Yeah.
So then you go back home and you're married, so you're living together. And correct me if I'm wrong, but you're thinking, well, once we're married, my parents, I know them, they'll have to adjust. They're not going to tell you to get divorced, right?
Well, I don't know that they would tell me, but as far as adjusting, that was a decision that they would have to make. I'd made my decision.
Okay.
And now it was up to them what they were going to
do. So you didn't know if they would just disown you forever?
Oh, they could disown me, yes.
You thought that was a possibility?
Oh, yes, definitely.
And then you go to the Japanese-American church and hide out in the basement.
Well, actually, it was Dad's grandpa. He lived...
Wahei. Okamoto.
Yes. He lived...
In the church. And so you had a hiding spot ready
to
go.
Well, we went there and used his phone. And then I informed all my siblings.
Yeah. And Dad called his family.
We went to Dad's house.
Oh, you went to Dad's house. How did they react?
When he left Spokane to come down to pick me up, he told his mother, I'm leaving. Oh, where are you going? I'm going to bring Sue home. And
that was enough said.
That was all that he said.
Yeah. Two families of very little communication.
Yes.
So, yeah, there's a whole rabbit hole we could go down around these phone calls, but one of the main... stories to tell is that your parents were in Kansas at a wedding.
Oh, that's a lovely story. It's kind of something from the movies.
Yeah. So your cousin is getting married in Kansas, and it's the wedding that your parents would have loved, where it has all the flowers and the people and the guest list, and it's a white couple and it has all the things, and they are at the wedding. And,
no.
Well, they're on the way to the reception. They're
on the way to the ceremony.
Oh, to the ceremony. Oh, I thought they were on the way to the reception. Okay, so they're driving from wherever they're staying to the ceremony. It's kind of a long highway.
Yes. Think Kansas. Think
flat plains.
Flat, one road, no lights, no traffic.
Yeah. That's always what's in my head.
No, nothing. I mean, just wheat fields or whatever, this grain on either side. And they're just on their way to my cousin's wedding.
You had a sister-in-law who was more talkative and communicative and vocally, outwardly against the fact that her younger sister-in-law had rebelled against the family and married a Japanese-American guy. So she calls... She's trying to get a hold of your parents.
She thinks they ought to know.
Your brother is, in his typical way, staying out of it. Mm-hmm. Vern Jr., very quiet fella, but his wife, not so quiet, is going to take action and is trying to track down your parents and, of course, just calling around. And she's informed that they had left. They're on the road. That doesn't stop her. She calls the police, literally calls the police in Kansas, which is not 911. It's back then. It would be some she had to probably look up the local county sheriff or something.
What is that, Smokey and the Bandit or yeah. some kind of thing?
Yeah,
right. Sunglasses.
Yeah. Call the police. Imagine the police. You get this phone call, and she tells them the situation. They have to, you have to inform, not waiting for even the ceremony, because you could certainly call the venue. The police, they take action, which is bizarre. Can you imagine calling the police and under these circumstances? Today they'd be like,
go inform them that their daughter got married.
What's wrong with you? And so the police actually turn their sirens on mm-hmm. and manage to find your parents' car by description, pull them over, mm-hmm. inform them on the side of a highway in Kansas that their princess, blonde, white daughter has eloped and is now married to a disgusting brown person. And then...
They didn't say it that way.
Well, that's the implication.
Yeah.
That's the implication.
I guess.
That's the implication. And so then your parents are reeling, and the word spreads throughout the entire wedding, and your cousin would later tell you that the most exciting part of her own wedding was your wedding. Because that was all that anyone
could talk
about.
Well, it was really disappointing because everybody was mingling and everything, but the only conversation on anybody's lips was my wedding.
Yeah.
What I had done and not their wedding.
And your parents are furious, I'm guessing.
Well, I don't know. Disappointed, surely.
Yeah.
And what can they do? They're probably wondering how can they reverse it?
Yeah, right. Which didn't amount to anything. And then they found out you're pregnant, so then it's even more of a done deal. Then, kind of skipping ahead through the history for the listeners out there, your parents slowly warm up to the idea and slowly warm up to Dad. I know because there's film footage that I have on my computer of by that Christmas, so this would have been June, early June, that the wedding happened. By Christmas, December, you and Dad are over at the house with a young baby, Mark. And Dad's being treated as a family member by that point.
Yes, he was very well embraced.
Eventually.
And when you say slowly, it was slowly in my mind because the days would go slow for me. But when you think that we got married in June and then this was Christmas, that was really brief,
yeah.
Truly.
But I know that from what you told me that there was a few weeks or months where there was radio silence from your parents.
Right,
where they just didn't contact you or anything, even though they knew you were married and pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but then to me, that was also kind of normal. I mean, it was...
Hands-off parenting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then not only that they eventually accepted and were cool with Dad, they eventually... really fell in love with Dad and us kids.
Yes. There wasn't any problem once they knew who Dad was. I mean,
Dad is he's a charming guy and very non-threatening mm-hmm. and a good listener.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
There wasn't anything to dislike about him except for his race, you know. And I'd like to have had conversations with my parents about race because they weren't like adamant. They were never angry towards blacks or towards
Asians,
people of color. So their coming around wasn't, I just wished I had given them more credit. I think they may have come around, who knows? Because in a matter of 6 months they did, mm-hmm. just in knowing Alan and knowing he's not a bad guy, mm-hmm. He has something to offer.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
And no joke, he became the favorite. Our family, correct me if I'm wrong.
He found out only when we went on our trip to Salina. a couple of years ago.
In Kansas.
My cousin, whose wedding we disrupted, he pulled Alan aside and he said, my father told my cousin that Alan was his number one.
Yeah. In-law.
In-law.
Child-in-law. Yeah. There's a clip of your 25th anniversary party where granddad, he says that our family is his favorite.
Yes.
And his grandkids, me and my siblings, are his favorite.
She fooled us and ran off and got married when we were down at two other weddings, but her wedding turned out better than any of the rest we've ever been to. It's a wonderful family. We love all of them. They're some of our best thought up children that we've got.
And when we would go out to the lake property in Hayden Lake in Idaho, you would get the A-frame beds and your siblings would be stuck in the barn, literally a barn.
Or trailer.
Anyway, we could get into the weeds on that one for Geralyn's sake, I suppose, cousin Geralyn. But the transition was not only, you know, relatively fast, but also swung, you know, pretty far. And to the point where eventually your parents are very much interested in Japan. They are hosting Japanese exchange students, Ikuko, and having the sister city thing. Your dad help build, design the Japanese garden that still stands in Spokane.
Well, not design. That was beautifully done by a true Japanese landscape architect. My father's part in the garden was that he did the construction.
Mm-hmm. And to the point where most of the Japanese-American accoutrement in my house is from your parents. So it's an interesting journey. And when you talk about how they weren't at least openly racist when you were growing up, and that you maybe should have given them more benefit of the doubt, it just makes me wonder, yeah, if we could talk to them back then and really get down to it, what was the motivation? Is it truly some racist held notions? It would be weird if they didn't have racist notions, by the way.
Oh, yes, it would have been weird.
So I wonder if your parents, if we could really drill down with them, even in the 60s, when you got married, if they would say things like, well, we just worry, because that was another thing.
It was a big worry. What about our children?
Yeah,
everybody was so worried that our children would be abused, bullied, any number of bad things.
Right, that was always, and it's a racist trope sometimes, an excuse that they'll say that we're trying to protect kids, but it's really just an excuse to be racist. But on the flip side, it could actually be a legitimate concern given the way that people treated mixed race kids. And maybe it was that. They're just such bad communicators that they didn't sit you down and say something like, look, we love you and we don't want to stand in the way of you choosing who you want to spend the rest of your life with. And certainly we don't think any lesser of him or you, but you should be aware of these problems and we're worried or whatever. You know, it's a much different conversation, but the way they communicated is through control and abuse and just putting their foot down and not having any conversation. So you just have to wonder what was going on there, because the switch for them was so quick and so...
It was very quick.
And so far from what you would imagine, because if they were truly...
Not just a silent acceptance.
Right, a tolerance, right?
Embraced everything.
Right.
Embraced our family, embraced the Japanese culture through the sister city exchanges, embraced the Japanese Spokane community, became friends with the leaders within that community. My parents were remarkable through all of that.
It makes you wonder, I never thought about it till now, but maybe the fact that you were open to dating dad in the first place and didn't have that knee-jerk reaction of racist concerns, maybe that was subtly passed down to you from your parents in a way. Because it seems like if that is the way they were after you got married, there might be attitudes and perspectives that were present prior. Because I've always framed it as your parents, maybe particularly your dad, was just kind of your classic racist who, you know, the sort of caricature of what I imagine.
Well, you're coming from the South and being conservative and that sort of thing. But I don't know. It almost makes me wonder what would have happened had I been more open and
forced it, maybe.
But stood my ground earlier.
Yeah.
Rather than being responsive, I could have been active.
Yeah. I mean, you were being abused, but it's asking a lot of you. But what would have happened if you would have endured that and just continued to batch? By the way, I'm still with him, and that's just the way it's, because once you got married, they could have continued to be racist
and abusive and cut us off.
But that choice that you made in this very outward affirmative way was your line in the sand, and in a way you could say they respected that. So if you had drawn that line earlier, like mm-hmm. shown the ring of like, we're engaged. So you just wonder, like, would they have adjusted earlier? Yeah, mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting. Again, it's a lot to ask of an 18, 19-year-old young, inexperienced girl who's literally being beaten.
I'm going from day to day.
Yeah, but it is interesting. Well, we only got to 3 questions, Mom.
I know, and I'm really anxious to talk more.
Well, let's adjourn here, and let's record another time, and maybe we can get through the questions. Because I feel like a lot of the questions had to do with this, by the way.
Oh.
So we actually hit on probably a set of 15 questions within that conversation. But I know that a lot of the questions were indicating that a lot of listeners were curious about that story. Mm. And I knew a lot of what we talked about, but I there were a lot of new things in there. And I think, you know, it's quite a dramatic story. And so in conclusion, what I'll say, Mom, is that I'm sure the listeners are agreeing with this, that it is extremely commendable, you know, and I'll tear up thinking about it, the strength of character that you had and have. You know, you fall in love with who you fall in love with, and to just know, you know, without any kind of hesitation, and to stand by your man, as they say. Right? The thing that I'll ask Dad about this at times, like, I'll ask Dad, how did Mom deal with the racism? Like, what were you seeing? And Dad will say, like, well, she just knew that the racism was wrong. She just knew that. And how, you know, because it wasn't like you had some social justice course or any kind of support around that. It wasn't a topic of conversation among white people.
There were no conversations, no internet, no magazines, whatever. You know, I mean, you get...
Not even a movement
in
the news, right? It wasn't until later in the 60s, civil rights, right? And that this girl from suburban Spokane would just know, even though she was rich and privileged and... In all the ways, really, you know, you literally had a debutante ball, right?
What they called the white cotillion.
White cotillion, which is for the Masons, right?
Yes, I believe so.
Like the...
Or the city fathers.
Yeah, and I'll show it. Maybe I'll post a picture of this somewhere, but you are the pinnacle of white privilege in this photograph. I mean, you have this dress and you have your...
I apologize for all
that. Well, how are you supposed to know? You're 15, and you have your attendants, right? You have your friends that are with you in lesser positions, and you have, I think, literally a scepter and a crown, and you're paraded around, and you look like a Marilyn Monroe, and your hair is all done up, and you come from that, and you know that the racism is wrong. It's just incredible, you know?
Well, I have to say, I did have a very, very privileged life. I didn't feel it at the time. I didn't know I was privileged. But when it became apparent, I started getting a feeling of it at high school level, and it became really uncomfortable. It was a place that didn't fit who I was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just so weird that you would have that. And I don't know.
I was that bouncy little blonde, curly-haired girl.
Tomboy.
Playing in the dirt.
Yeah.
That's who I am.
Well, it also it does make me wonder about what subtle messages your parents might have actually given you that we might not give them credit for, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, some kids do emerge out of difficulty and out of where there's literally no influence that is influencing them to find the strength. They do find the strength. That does happen. But it just makes me wonder if your dad's modest upbringing, and your mom's too, but particularly your dad's, was subtly talked about or indicated or something. I don't know. But at least, it's very strange that to me, and I think to the listeners, that without any influence from the outside, any direct influence for sure, without any conversation in society, just imagine that. Like, racism is just a given. You don't need to even talk about racism because everyone understands. The Jim Crow South is still around. There are laws in the books in states that white people can't intermingle with other literal laws passed by legislatures, meaning prison time or citations if you're caught. It's like something from, I don't know, just another time. And it's just the norm. And for you to just make a choice of, no, that doesn't make any sense. Alan is the love of my life, and that's just the way it's going to be. And everyone else can go to hell. And to have your family and your parents and your and dad's family to some extent, community as well, everyone, no one's supporting it. I mean, that's always the thing.
We had no support.
That's always the thing of, that's a big part, especially when you're that age, of everyone's supportive. Everyone's like, yay, the cute couple is here. Oh, two lovebirds. That cocooning around you of a community and acceptance and a venue, you know, and that you'd have to work against so much odds. There were so many points where it'd be just so easy just to, you know, maybe you wait a little longer sending a letter back and you think, God, is this all worth it? Is this a pain in the ass? You know, there are a lot of boys in the fraternity next door that I wouldn't have to hide about and I'd be able to see more often. There, you know, there's so many different temptations and to just know. And to be here 60 years later, right?
Yahoo! 60 years.
Yeah. Well, do you absorb that, Mom? You know what I'm saying?
When I hear it from your mouth, I just did what I did. And it wasn't easy, but it just had to be done. I mean, it just...
Was it love?
Yes.
Was that what you would say?
Yeah.
Love. That's what...
There and connection. I mean, there was, you know, I mean, you can love sexually or through the mind or whatever, but no, there's a connection. This person and I need to be together.
You just knew.
Just knew.
Both knew.
And really... you know, they talk about being colorblind or something, and I guess I was. I mean, it just...
Regarding race.
Yeah, with regard to race. It just it was a non-issue.
Mm-hmm.
Just...
See the human.
Yeah, human. We're talking people here. Mm-hmm. We're talking eyes, nose, ears.
Yeah. And, you know, there... were trials and tribulations as a mixed race kid myself, but I think it's more of a pro than a con because to summarize an entire lifetime, particularly as a child, I'll say that it wasn't that much of an issue, but it was at times and it hurt and I was bullied and I was called names, but I think I had a strong family that was there for me. And friends and community, you know, we lived in the same community throughout my entire childhood, pretty much. And so everyone, you know, I had social capital, as they say. I had friends, I had people that knew me, I had people that I could depend on. And when, you know, when the racism things would happen, it would often be a new kid in school, someone that didn't know me and my community and thought that was okay to do to me. And so it was more of an anomaly. The other benefit was that I was a giant as a child, so people didn't usually mess with me just on that fact, and when they did, you'd usually manhandle them, so I benefited that way. But I think the other pro is that it taught me from a young age about culture, not just race and ethnicity, but that I think I slowly was learning, oh, there's this notion in society that there are beliefs that people have about people based on their race or their skin and color or something. And they're wrong. What else is wrong in society? What else should I be questioning? What am I wrong about? I remember having those subtle thoughts that really planted seeds that grew into things once I was a teenager and really philosophizing a lot by that point. And that's a huge gift, you know, to be given that early experience, that to question things and not to take things for granted and not take things as gospel. Just because society or the pulpit or your friends or the television are telling you things, it's not necessarily true, and it could be dangerous. Because I've been at the wrong end of the stick regarding the dangerous notions that other people have been brainwashed around. But yeah, so thanks for coming on the podcast, Mom. We'll have to have you back again and get to the other 97 questions.
Well, I do know there's a great interest about you and your young life.
Yeah. So we'll have to get into that next time. Mm-hmm. And everyone out there, please take care of yourself because
you deserve it.